From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum next, journalist Amana Fontanella Khan tells the story of Sampat Pal, a poor, illiterate girl who was married at the age of 12 and went on to lead a brigade of women in India who have stood up to corrupt police and gangsters. They defend victims of rape and domestic violence, in some cases even beating abusive husbands with sticks. 1 week after four men were sentenced to death for the brutal gang rape of a woman in Delhi, we talked to Fontanella Khan about her book, Pink Sari Revolution, and with other panelists about women in India, rape and abuse, gender inequalities, and gender segregation, and perhaps a brighter future ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another Forum Hour. Our second hour this morning, The Pink Sari Revolution, a tale of women in power in India, tells the story of a movement in India's largest state where food scarcity is more severe than the sub-Sahara and many lawless areas are overrun by crime and poverty is rampant. Yet a grassroots movement of women flourishes under the leadership of Sampat Pal, a woman in her 50s who commands literally tens of thousands of pink sari women with pink batons and pink bamboo sticks who confront injustice and sexual and domestic abuse. We're going to find out more about this movement in this hour and its leader. And also, we want to address issues of gender inequality and the treatment of women in India in general. There's lots to cover here. We thought we would go first to Julie McCarthy, who is NPR's correspondent based in New Delhi, because as many of you know, just 4 days ago, there was a verdict rendered, and it was a death sentence to the rapist in a much publicized and really a horrible case that got a good deal of attention. Julie McCarthy, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I guess the initial question I'd like to ask you is there a feeling because of this capital punishment being handed down to these rapists who killed this young woman that maybe things are moving for more justice where women are concerned?
Well, I don't think that the imposition of capital punishment necessarily does that. Although there is a great wellspring of the public who supported that move, and you certainly saw that in spades in Parliament, where in many ways you could make the case that the politicians of this country were angling to look as though they were very tough on crime, and so they went ahead and enacted tougher penalties on things like gang rape, where the minimum is now 20 years. You can draw the death penalty if a victim of rape is left in a quote unquote vegetative state. In this instance, you know, what you had really was a case of murder. And a cold-blooded murder in the eyes of the judge. Now, his whole point in imposing that was certain justice. Now, others on the other side of this question of capital punishment talk about that in terms of extreme justice and feel that extreme justice is not how you go about righting the wrongs of women in this society, and there are plenty of them. Michael, something in the order of 244,000 reported crimes were committed against women last year. That's 10% of the total crimes in India. And we're not talking about rape and murder. We're talking about kidnapping and dowry deaths and spouse abuse and trafficking in women and assault on women.
Now, rape is the fastest growing crime in the country now, with convictions dropping. And that's true about domestic violence. The women are, as I read, willing to report more. So there has been some change in that sense.
Well, you know, there has been a rather remarkable, almost doubling, actually a doubling of the case, more than a doubling of the number of reported cases in the first 8 months of the year here in Delhi. And why is that happening? Police say that this case itself ignited in women a sense that they had to report and has emboldened women to report the crime. Others suspect something a little more different, and there really hasn't been a whole lot of discussion about this or study of it. People feel that there is a backlash against women underway in this society, where women are outcompeting men for jobs, in schools. And as I say, none of this has been scientifically unpacked, but it is a rather stark figure, no matter how you slice it, and it reveals this sort of enormous undercurrent of sexual violence, more than 1,000 rapes in the capital of India in the first 8 months of this year.
Does that also quicken in some way or highlight the necessity of doing self-examination? I mean, what is it in our culture that's breeding this, that kind of questioning?
Well, it certainly did in the beginning. There's no doubt about that. It did lift a taboo about discussing how prevalent sexual harassment is. And then, of course, that did force the parliament to move. But, you know, here's a very interesting point about all of that. And, you know, the parliament only acted when the public was in a fury and out on the streets. Sexual abuse is not only prevalent, but so tolerated here that sitting members of parliament and state assemblies have been charged with sexual assault, and they have not lost their seats. You would be drummed out of office in many places in the world at the allegation. But there seems to be a culture of abuse that has, up until this point, been accepted.
Julie McCarthy with us from New Delhi, correspondent with NPR. Thank you so much for joining us, Julie.
Thank you.
Also joining us for this hour here in studio is Amana Fontanella Khan. She's the author of Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women in Power in India. And she's a contributor to Slate, The Daily Beast, formerly a contributing editor to Vogue India. Thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We also have with us in studio this hour Sunita Tasarji.
Sarabji.
Sarabji, thank you. You know, if I just look at your name, it would be fine, but when I look at the phonetics, it throws me. She's a staff reporter with India West. She's appeared on Forum before, and they're a national print weekly and online publication for the Indian American community. Thank you for joining us. And you got an Indian Miss America. I mean, that in itself is big news. We should just mention it. But I want to talk first, if I may, Amana, with you, Amana Fontanella Khan, because I think many of us here in the United States, I can say I knew nothing about the Pink Sari Revolution or about Sambat Pal, and should mention that this is an extraordinary story. It's a brigade of literally tens of thousands of women, a kind of sisterhood or women in power, with Sambat Pal as the chief, and she herself is a fascinating character, married off at the age of 12 and pregnant at 15 and prohibited from attending school and now lives with a man out of wedlock, which in itself is pretty revolutionary. But there are women who are going in and confronting abusive husbands and cops and robbers alike. And you call them vigilantes, but I don't know if that they're trying to move more not outside the law, but to have the law enforced, aren't they?
That's right. I mean, I think that they, you know, they kind of straddle two worlds, sort of half, they're sort of half vigilantes and half sort of activists. I think the term vigilantism applies to them to a certain extent because they, you know, they are armed with sticks, they appear in big mobs, and they have cultivated a very muscular, aggressive kind of aura. So when they arrive, there's definitely, they're employing the threat of violence. They very rarely carry that threat out, but the fact that it's kind of hanging there, you know, definitely kind of you know, suggest that they use vigilante tactics.
It's an amazing grassroots story, though, because they have been effective. I mean, you tell the story initially, for example, this young girl who is with a legislator, and she's accused of theft by him, and he, very powerful guy, and takes on her brother and her father and harasses them and so forth. And the truth of the matter is he raped her.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And really, it's she probably wouldn't have gotten justice had the Pink Gang not gotten involved. And, you know, the way that they go about solving cases when they're brought to them is very interesting. They start out just by investigating. You know, they almost act like a detective agency at the very beginning. They'll go and they'll speak with, you know, as many people as possible to get a full picture of what happened. They'll speak to neighbors and, you know, brothers and sisters-in-law, you know, bypassers, whoever might like be able to shed some light on what actually happened. And when they feel comfortable about, you know, taking on a case, they'll go to the police station. That's their first port of call. They'll involve the local police and try to get them to investigate. What was interesting in the case of Shilu, this girl who was accused of theft by the politician, when Sampat went to the police, they actually told her, one of the policemen told her, you know what, Sampat, we can't actually investigate. There's a lot of political pressure on us. Our hands are tied. You're going to have to do this. So, you know, there's times where the police just can't, are not willing to do anything. And that's when, you know, the Pink Gang will go and sort of literally just take things into their own hands. They'll get the media involved. And then, you know, if there's still no progress, that's when they take to the streets.
Can you tell about when they went to the electric utility company?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story. Right at the beginning of the gang's sort of existence, back in 2006 when they were formed, there was a local electricity office that was denying power to the local community, and they were only going to turn it on if they were given either bribes or sexual favors. And so what the gang did was they stormed this office, and they, you know, they kind of actually like managed to lock in the officials into their office, and they did not let them out until the power was back on. And it was really actions like this that that garnered the support for them. Now there's a huge amount of support on a local level because people, you know, people think that they're fighting the right battles.
But they're in an area that is so corrupt. I mean, it's like Badlands, you know, it's like parts of Pakistan that people don't even want to go to. It's one of the biggest states in India, but they've gotten involved in so much, in dowry deaths and child marriages and sexual and domestic abuse, as we said, eloping couples who will come under the threat of honor killings. They've even gotten into the whole caste system, or at least to the degree of officiating in intercaste marriages and championing the lower so-called pariah or outcast.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I mean, you wouldn't think that, you know, that this sort of women's gang, this kind of sort of vigilante gang, would be in the business of officiating marriages. But when you look at the caste system, you quickly understand that its fate hinges on the institution of marriage. Marriage is the primary vehicle through which the caste system is perpetuated, because if you marry within your caste, that's kind of, you know, how it continues. And that's why so-called love marriages are anathema to many traditional sort of community members, because they view it as a threat. And so so-called eloping couples who've fallen in love with someone out of their caste are sometimes persecuted, and in extreme cases, they risk honor killings. And so what the Pink Gang does is they organize these public marriages where they sort of get the couples up on a dais in front of everyone in the community, and they say that this couple has a right to exist, they have a right to love each other and to live peacefully. And that really helps to lift the stigma. It's very much like, you know, if you take gay marriage, just the fact that, you know, you have like Supreme Court judge who goes and endorses or herself officiates a gay marriage sends a powerful message out to the community.
Of course, I'm sure they're seen by interlopers, and there's a lot of enmity against them and animus and ill will as well. But they are certainly mobilizing women, and the story is a dramatic and extraordinary one. Amana Fontanella Khan tells the story in her book, Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women and Power in India. I just want to talk a little bit more about Sampa Paulo, because as I said, she's a fascinating character. And I mean, you go back to her early days when there's a very scatological story. I don't know if mm-hmm. we have to get into detail here, but shall we say using waste material to fight against somebody who she felt was wronging her and others, even as a young girl, but also getting out early on and fighting and demonstrating to make sure that a road was built and paved in the right way.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, Sampat really, you know, she organized her first protest at the age of 8. And, you know, since then, she's just always been very good at, sort of opposing oppressors and fighting back. And, you know, she's had to do this from the age of 12 when she was married off, and her in-laws wanted her to be little more than a servant. You know, as soon as she was married off, they wanted her to sort of, run these sort of very exhausting errands in the fields.
Can I read a quote that you have of her?
Yes.
Women live in slavery. That's right, directly from her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and she came to that conclusion fairly early on. Yeah.
She did, yeah. I mean, she just saw the realities around her, and to her, it was slavery. She wasn't allowed to, sort of travel freely. She wasn't allowed to speak to people who she wanted to. She was her parents-in-law wanted her to, hide behind the purdah or veil, she refused. But many women just don't have the strength or courage to, and they're just sort of, you know, they exist within the confines set by others.
The book again is Pink Sari Revolution. The author Amana Fontanella Khan. And we're also with Sarita Sarabji, who's here with us in studio with India West as a staff reporter and has certainly been covering much about India for the Indian American community. And let's get back to the problems that women have, because you yourself were You were grabbed on a bus, and this is commonplace,
that was
right?
That was a while ago. But to get back to the issue of empowerment, it's interesting to see how women in the villages are becoming empowered, because there's now a quota system that allots a third of all village council seats to women. And I think as women see other women in these leadership roles, they get a sense of power.
Sampat Pal's thinking of running for political office, in fact, yes. I believe. Isn't that true?
That's right. She's run on two occasions and she wants to run again.
But how, let me get from you, if I can, Sunita, how much are these roles really changing? I mean, you know, we just heard a report earlier from the BBC about, you know, women just still getting grabbed and being harassed and you know, things being done untoward to them constantly, ubiquitous.
Absolutely. And I think that that is going to be a constant in India for women. But I think there's also the trajectory of women becoming empowered because we are in leadership roles in India. In one village in Rajasthan, a young woman managed to get women are concerned with water infrastructure because they have to gather most of the water every day and walk some distance to gather it. So water is very much a concern for women in India. And in Rajasthan, there was one village where a very young woman managed to get a road created to a water facility. And that was revolutionary. It changed the life for women in that village. And I think as women hear of these types of situations and see women becoming empowered, I feel that they themselves feel a sense of empowerment and moving forward.
And the internet has obviously affected that. I mean, because the accessibility of seeing women and exchanging ideas and so forth being so much more available. So the roles are changing, but you still have so many issues. I mean, there's a sense of the police not doing enough. There's a sense of India being a misogynistic culture in many ways, women being second-class citizens, not to mention, of course, the caste system. And women are getting more jobs, as Julie McCarthy said. Mm-hmm. And that's also a problem, isn't it? I mean, when men see themselves being essentially one up by women getting jobs that they want.
I think so. And a lot of the philanthropic efforts have been targeted at young women so that women are equipped to go into middle-income jobs. And I think that that does create some sort of, I don't know what you would call it, but antagonistic attitude from young men who are also competing for those types of jobs.
And there's still a great number of abortions for those who know that they're carrying a female in their womb as a fetus that's not male.
Yes, I think gender imbalance is as prevalent as issues of rape and sexual violence in a community in Gujarat. There are about 521 girls for every 1,000 boys. And nationally, I believe the statistics, are about 900 girls for every 1,000 boys. And so the devaluation of women at a very early age is still very prevalent in Indian society.
Do you think the Pink Sari Revolution and Sampat Pal are making a major impact?
I think so. Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, not just to their region, though, even throughout the country?
I think as women see this happening in this area, that they themselves are going to feel empowered as well and choose to bring it into their own village.
Again, Sunita Sarabji is staff reporter for India West. We also have Sonia Falero with us. She's the author of Beautiful Thing, Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bar. She's with us this morning from London. And Sonia Falero, good to have you with us on Forum. We welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, it's not morning there, but to have you here. There is a sense of, back in March, there were some tougher laws on essentially sexual harassment and those sorts of things, and more seems to be opening up. There's more discussion. Are you optimistic?
I am. I'm very optimistic. You know, one of the things that I feel very strongly about is that when we frame these discussions, we have to keep in mind that the changes we talk about affect the middle class, which is about 20% of the population, because the middle class is the one that gets interviewed, the one that talks, and the one that has access to the media, you know, whether it's television, radio, or social media. But even in the middle class, that sets the agenda and therefore determines what the police and lawmakers do. Even in the middle class, the changes are, to my mind, extraordinary. Because when I was growing up, as a young woman in India, even into my late 20s, we never spoke about being groped or any form of sexual harassment. And I remember when I used to take the bus when I was in my early 20s, I was encouraged by a friend to carry a knife with me, which is, of course, something that I never did. What I used to do instead was wake up 3 hours early and take the 7 a.m. bus instead of taking, and reach work at 8 a.m. instead of 11:30. And that's how I protected myself. But now we are in a situation where the middle class is making sure that these conversations are in the headlines. And rapes that would have been pushed to the back of the newspaper or not registered at all in the public consciousness are being spoken about all the time. The air is saturated with information about women's rights, and this has never happened before.
Well, there was also, we spoke earlier with Julie McCarthy, NPR's correspondent who's in New Delhi, and I had asked her about the effect of this capital punishment sentence. I think there were a lot of women who were perhaps even surprised and maybe elated that the severity of the sentence was unprecedented, but happened pretty speedily.
Yes, this is, of course, an extraordinary case. You know, it captured the public imagination, and the brutality of the rape, I should point out, is something that, we've seen in different, slightly different ways in other circumstances. It was just that this young woman was somebody that the middle class could identify with, and therefore we became obsessed with her story. And that public obsession translated into this incredibly speedy activity on the part of the police. Of course, right now you have, in excess of 50,000 rape cases that are pending in the courts that will never see this kind of resolution. But we need to start somewhere, and we need to set some sort of example. And although this punishment that was delivered was for the murder and not the rape, the fact is that it does send a strong message. You have a section of the population who feels that, now people, the rapists will merely realize that they have to murder their victims and make sure there are no witnesses. But just the severity of the punishment needs to serve as a deterrent. One cannot give a less severe punishment because we really think that our criminals are so so extraordinarily vile that they will murder to get rid of all evidence. So it's something that's, one can't say heartening, but given the circumstances, it's the best outcome.
Well, we're talking about empowering women in India, the Pink Sari Revolution, which is also certainly affecting things, Gulabi Gang, they're known as, and we'd like to hear from you. In fact, encourage those of you who are listening to join this conversation. You may have questions or comments, in fact, about Sampat Pal, about the Pink Sari Revolution, which is, as I said, an extraordinary grassroots movement that has affected all of India, though it's up there in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. But we welcome your involvement in the program, and it's an opportunity for you to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. I'd like to hear certainly from some of you with backgrounds, Indian ancestry, or who are here from India, either living in the United States with Indian citizenship or have become American citizens, and have some experience having observed some of what we're talking about here. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. You can also join us by going to our website with any questions or comments, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We welcome your involvement, so please feel free to contribute and join the conversation. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about women in India and the sense of things moving towards some kind of empowerment or recognition of empowerment, though right now, in fact, Sunita Sarabji informs me that 80% of cases involving sexual abuse or rape or molestation or sexual harassment are simply unreported. And the biggest problem, of course, and that's why the Pink Sari movement has been mobilized and has gone into action, is inaction and also things that are not only not acted upon, but a great deal of corruption and, typical kind of ignoring or power having suasion and that sort of thing. So it really is a problem of justice. And the Pink Sari Revolution, by the way, they wear pink because they didn't want to be identified necessarily with anything political or religious specifically. But the Pink Sari Revolution has certainly made some inroads. So we wanted to bring these together. And we want to, of course, bring you into the discussion. Neil from Sunnyvale writes about the Pink Gulagi Revolution. I take strong exception to characterization that these women are vigilantes. In India, violence and threat of violence is how the ossified social structures are kept in power. All these women are doing is demanding that the rule of law be followed, nothing more. Amanda?
Yeah, I think, you know, the fact is that, look, I think the Gulabi gang is you know, is fighting the right fight. I also think that the means with which they take on this battle is justified, given the fact that they essentially live in an area that is lawless. They're living in an area where you just can't turn to the police often for help, and so. It's understandable that they would, you know, arm themselves and use the threat of violence. They have, on some occasions, you know, assaulted people. They, some part, assaulted a police officer, not badly. I mean, it was just a sort of a mild kind of level of violence that was used. But the fact that they're armed, I think, sets them apart from just your regular kind of.
This may be a semantic problem. People think of vigilantes. You know, they think of Bernard Goetz on the subway. You know, shooting people and that sort of thing. But there's certainly a sense of their being menacing to some of these men that they confront from reading your book. Amrit writes, fun fact, I think the Gulabi gang, Pink Sari gang, has a chapter in Paris. Is that true?
Yes, that's right. I mean, yes, it's true.
Okay. And Alec writes on our website, it seems that in a country with many languages and several religions, the essential problem is one of social conservatism. The aggressors speak of women's respectability, which is a vague term poorly defined by bullies, and they naturally view non-respectable women to be fair targets. But I wonder if at some point in the future, when Indian women have achieved general respect and freedom in India, will those women themselves be able to reject the addictive bullying that social conservatism permits and become what Americans call liberals, or will newly respected Indian women disapprove of atheists, interracial marriages, gays, Dalits, and other marginalized groups? Anybody want to forecast here? Serene, Sunita?
Please.
Amana?
So the question, well, I don't know. I mean, it's so difficult to say. What's interesting is Sampa, you know, she has a song about how she tells a tale of women who are married off into a home and they are tormented by their mother-in-law. They're tormented and it's hellish. But then when they grow up and they are a mother-in-law in themselves, that they carry out that same kind of harassment.
Can I point out the fact, I think this is true, that despite her strong positions and all of her passion and all that she's mobilized so far, talking about having been married off at 12, she married off her daughters as teenagers, didn't she not?
That's right. I mean, she has.
That's how embedded things are.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, it wasn't her choice. She was forced by her in-laws. She was just pressured continuously to do this.
That's why she got that song. I understand, but this is a woman that doesn't seem to take pressure from anybody.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's a very painful part of her life. I mean, she kind of opened up to me on this subject. You know, like a year or and a half into our sort of relationship, it's definitely, I think, her greatest failure and her greatest source of pain that three of her four daughters were married off at such a young age. But you know, the perverse thing is that in these kind of communities, child marriage is often portrayed as being for the benefit of women, because the rhetoric is it's so dangerous here in this part of the country, and it's better for you to be married off so you're safe, you're protected. And so you even have a chief minister who he was just sort of arguing to lower the kind of the marriage age for this reason. He claimed that it would help women, you know. So, you know, this is the kind
of. What is the marriage age now?
I think it's 18.
It's 18, yeah. How low did he want to go? I mean, girls being married at 8 years old in Yemen, and you read about that case where this young girl was actually physically harmed quite seriously as a result of her consummation, so to speak. I mean, it's hideous to even think about that. Mm-hmm. By the way, one other thing about Sampat Pal that we should mention is she became financially independent on her own through teaching herself how to sew. I mean, she got agency, really, through economics.
Absolutely. I mean, Sampa, the thing to bear in mind about her is that she's ferociously intelligent. I mean, she really is one of the smartest people
too.
I've ever met. Incredibly funny, incredibly witty. She really is smart. And so she taught herself how to sew. And she was the first woman in her village to acquire this skill. And she used it to become financially independent. She was giving sewing lessons and she was working as a seamstress. And when she was giving the sewing lessons, it was interesting. She was very deliberately imparting this gift of sewing to other local women with the explicit aim of empowering them and helping them to become independent. And during these classes, she would kind of give them these messages about women's power. And to her, financial independence and women's empowerment are closely linked.
The book, again, is The Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women in Power in India. And I should mention that Amana Fontanella Khan will be signing and speaking at City Lights Bookstore on the 19th of September. That's tonight at 7 p.m. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let's go to Blani. Excuse me. Welcome.
Hello.
Yes. Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Being an Indian citizen, and I'm 26, I came to the U.S. 5 years ago to get my master's degree. I'm working in San Mateo right now. Being from Bombay, which is considered to be at least safer, even though it's really funny when we say that, it's considered to be safer than New Delhi. I think the verdict that came out for the New Delhi rape, I think I'm very, very happy about that, especially happy that the justice wasn't delayed. Usually cases like this take, like, you know, years together. The family of the girl is also, you know, there's so many people. The family is gone by the time the justice comes. So it's not something that happens really fast. It's heartbreaking because being of the same age group, I feel very bad that I got the opportunity to get out of that place, get out of all these stares from men and lewd gestures on the trains, lewd gestures on the buses. I feel really great that I could get out and I could make something out of my life. I feel that opportunity that group would have had to make something out of her life and to, feel empowered, I think that is lost forever. And that's always going to break my heart. But I'm pretty happy that these guys got the death penalty, and even though I'm not very pro-death penalty, in this case, I think it was completely justified.
Well, Blani, thank you for sharing your thoughts, and good luck to you. I hope you continue to succeed here. I appreciate your joining us. We'll go to more calls here. Amir, hi. Welcome, Amir.
Hi, hi, Michael. I was in India for a book tour just in February, and what struck me was the way women are being used in advertising there, for soaps and this and that, and it was astonishingly predatory. So while we're talking about the sort of rise of the middle class as the solution, I wonder if the other side of it, which is a consumerism and using women to sell products, you know, when you've got all these kids in the big cities who aren't educated into things, I wonder what role advertising is playing in all of this.
Sonia Falero, I'd like to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, you know, he's absolutely right. And in fact, one of the huge shortcomings, well, I would say one of several shortcomings of the Indian film industry, is the fact that women are treated like objects. And the primary message of a lot of contemporary films is that if a woman says no to you, she simply wants you to try harder. That means you turn up at her doorstep, you call her up, you chase her down the street, you touch her to show your affection. And all this does is increase the number of stalking cases that women in India are subjected to. One of the excuses, the constant excuses that filmmakers give as to why the content of their films is frankly misogynistic and even dangerous, is that, well, this is what the masses want. And so, again, we have a situation where a filmmaker who is middle class or upper class has an excellent education, is usually studied in New York or London, and has family money, and is blaming the poor, the lower classes, for the for the films that he is making. And again, saying that, you know, it's not us. It's not the middle class that is predatory. It's the rest of them.
I don't know if I can make an editorial comment here, but I don't know that Hollywood does much better than Bollywood on that score. I did a piece years ago for Mother Jones, and I went down to Hollywood and asked all kind of, who's responsible for all this violence and the movies? And I got the answer, you know, essentially fobbing it off to other. The producer said, we have to please our investors. The investors said, you know, it's the people who write the scripts. Everybody said it's the public, and on it goes. But the commercialism certainly has to play a part of this. And let me actually go to some of your emails here. Divya writes, hi, I'm an Indian woman currently living in the United States. I feel like the punishment that was given to these men, though it sends some sort of message, is not enough to change the lot of Indian women. Even right after this horrific rape, there were political leaders saying it was the girl's fault because she was out late, not dressed properly, with a man who was not her husband, etc., etc. Until people in India change their attitude towards women completely, otherwise there's no way to ensure that women are safe. Sending a few men to death is not the answer. I do believe the country needs an overhaul in attitude. And Mona comments on Facebook, please high-five the Gulabi gang from all of us pink sari movers and shakers. and Charles from Middleton asks, I'm confused about 10 years ago, Richard Gere created a scandal by publicly kissing an Indian actress, but the Indian culture long has accepted public groping. Why the dichotomy? Can you help us here, Sunita?
I don't think the Indian culture has accepted groping. I think it just is something that we choose not to talk about because we're ashamed. There's no support for admitting that you were groped.
Amira from Berkeley says, one of the reasons I believe hugely contributes to the way women are being treated is the patriarchal attitudes and patriarchal social structure in India. What needs to happen to change this, and how can this change? Who would like to step up to that question, if you will? Mano, some thoughts from you?
Well, I think that there's,
Excuse me, I just want to dovetail on another email question because another woman says wants to ask you, Amana, can you please explain if the mindset of older women is changing, example, mother-in-laws and dowry deaths? So that kind of ties into the first question, doesn't it? If you're going to really change things, maybe you have to change not only the men, but the women too.
Yeah, that's right. You need to change the hearts and minds of an entire nation, really. And, to answer the question of how does one go about that, well, I think there's two issues here. First of all, there are sort of, there's sort of an embedded sexism and misogyny that's there in the culture. And, and that's sort of exacerbated by poor governance. So addressing the governance issues should be pretty straightforward, you know, just kind of making sure that the police are not corrupt, making sure that they respond to rape cases, you know, these sort of, you know, just kind of improving policing and speeding up the justice system will do a lot to bring down violence against women. But to like actually get to the core of the problem, I think what's really needs to be done is kind of a huge awareness raising and sort of sensitization program that sort of starts at really like the school level of like young boys and girls, teaching them that, that they're equal and that that violence and gender-based violence is never acceptable. It kind of requires a really concerted effort. Also, just kind of educating the people in power. We've heard so many really insensitive remarks from politicians, including female politicians, women who are part of the National Commission of Women, who are supposed to be, fighting for women's rights, blaming sort of rape survivors for what happened to them. Yeah, I think, what needs to be done is just sort of have this conversation and kind of get to a point where it's no longer acceptable, to discriminate. And I think it needn't take very long. If you look at, say, in the United States in the 80s, half of Americans thought domestic violence was acceptable in some occasions. And just a decade later, that figure dropped and it was only 20% that still thought it was acceptable. How do you get to that point? It's really just through continuously drilling home the message that it is, that it's not acceptable.
And also shame helps. I mean, making people ashamed of behaving that way. Sunita Sarajevich?
I think as women, young women start to achieve financial independence and become the breadwinners for their families, which is happening to a large degree, that their fathers and their family, the entire family, tends to value them more. They become the decision makers because they have the economic power to do so. There are several programs. There's a young woman from Stanford who has founded the Roshni Academy in New Delhi, which trains young women for vocational training. And most of them now have middle-class incomes of 15,000 rupees a month, which is a good job. So
there's certainly more women in the workplace, but it's mainly middle class, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Let me bring in more of our callers, and we'll go to Danville and welcome Asha. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that many of the thoughts I had in mind have been covered, but I did want to make the point that education, ignorance, and grassroots change, because the North still believes, and it cuts across educational boundaries, that men are indeed superior to women, and whether, whatever the situation, the man's position in the house is guaranteed, and by fiat, he can behave the way he does. In spite of the hypocrisy of worshipping Devi, the goddess, the female deity, the way things are carried out, again, it needs to be at the grass. So the change has to come from the men. The women have to train their boys and their men to know that women are of equal value, that the sex of the baby is determined not by the woman, but by the man. So doing infanticide is actually not at all a solution. And you see the difference between northerners and southerners. The South has had a tradition of women being educated. You see that in Kerala. You see the Kerala factor, a completely different scenario there. And the North, which was influenced by Islam and Muslims, that cultural embedding of the women being inferior is so strong that the change, since men hold the power, needs to come from them. They have to refuse the dowry. They have to refuse to do the things that are being perpetuated. So the pink sari revolution is great, but it's again using the same techniques as men have, which is fine to create a dialogue, but it's not one that's going to sustain the change.
Thank you, Asha, for those comments. In fact, I think I'm going to bring Marie in because her comments dovetail. Marie, welcome.
Thank you. I am actually calling just to say I think I agree with the previous listener. As women, we have a big part to play. A lot of these stereotypes all perpetuated by women, generation to generation, grandmothers, mothers, daughters, etc. And as a mother, I think I have a responsibility to teach my son that he is just the same as any other girl or his sister or his cousins. Teaching respect comes from the mother. Because of roles, again, all these stereotypes, India considers mothers akin to God. So then we have a bigger responsibility, and I think it's important that we keep that in mind.
Thank you for that. And let me just bring Alice on next. Alice, join us.
I wonder, in addition to the embedded traditional attitudes towards women, how access to the internet and pornography may be further aggravating men's disrespect and violence towards women.
Let me go to Sonia Falero on that. What do you think, Sonia?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
About the influence of pornography on the internet aggravating attitudes of men toward women in India?
Well, I mean, as much as anywhere else. It's not more or less. I think the primary reason is what one of your previous callers mentioned. You know, the subject of value keeps coming up. And if you go to a lot of the, especially the poorer families in India, in the small towns, in the rural areas, even in the cities, in fact, families don't see value in girls. They, in fact, see girls as sucking out the value from a family because the system of giving dowry is still so powerful that the families feel that, you know, there's no point educating children, educating girls, because it makes much more sense if they just spend all their efforts into accumulating money for dowry and then packing her off as soon as they can so that she is just one less person to feed. So this is it's really a problem with what we think of as tradition. And we have to change the mindset and say, well, you know what? Some traditions don't fit into modern life. Let's think of a new tradition. And in this new tradition, we don't value dowry. We just value our girls because they are as important to us and as relevant to our happiness as our sons.
And again, Sonia Falero is the author of Beautiful Thing Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bars, and she is with us from London. And Nahid is with us from Berkeley. Welcome, Nahid.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, and I lost a chunk of the conversation in between because I had to get to work and turn my radio off. So I have a quick question statement I hope your guests can respond to, which is that is any discussion of violence against women in India and the steps being taken to prevent it, empower them, however we want to term it, is it, can it ever be complete without addressing the state-perpetrated and organized violence against women in the occupied valley of Kashmir, where traditionally women were more empowered, and in perpetrating the crimes against women's bodies over there and the killing of the men folk who have traditionally been the supporters of the house, home and the family, is any conversation even complete without a nod or an acknowledgement of the crimes being perpetrated in the valley?
Sunita Saranjan?
I don't know how to answer that.
But what do we know about Kashmir has certainly it's been fought over for a long time in terms
and
of
and will be
and will continue to be. Yeah, is there some thoughts, Amana?
Sure. So Kashmir and some parts of the northeast of India are under the sort of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, which allows the military essentially to get away with rape and murder. And it has come to, it's really sort of been discussed a lot after the Delhi gang rape that, you know, people are becoming more aware of what's going on in these kind of conflict areas. And they're pointing to a certain amount of hypocrisy that the rapes that are happening in the center to middle class girls are being, you know, are eliciting sort of outrage, but rape perpetuated by the armed forces against, you know, sort of people in conflict zones are not. And so, no, I agree. I think that the two, you know, discussions need to happen at the same time.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking to Amana Fontanella Khan, to Sonia Falero, to Sunita Sarabji. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to some more of your calls. Let's bring you in. Marty, hi.
I spent 4 months in Gujarat last year, and I, of course, encountered this ubiquity of the abuse and mistreatment of women. Of course, in New Delhi, there's a women's car in the subway, as your guests all know, for precisely this reason. But what troubles me is I heard one of your guests, who are quite marvelous, say that this condition of misogyny and patriarchal abuse is a kind of a given, and it will persist. And I think the revolution must begin in the minds of those who are already enlightened, and an absolute refusal to tolerate that, starting now, beyond the conviction of those ridiculous fools who killed that woman. You know, this is something that should not be tolerated in New Delhi, in Gujarat, in Ahmedabad, in any city, in any town, whether north or south in India, starting immediately, and it begins with an internal commitment. That's just my thought.
I thank you for your thoughts, Marty. In fact, he mentions North and South. I'm looking at an email from a listener who wants to know about differences in women empowerment between the North and South, given the high literacy in the South. I think we've touched on that, and there are some pretty dramatic differences, aren't there, Sunita?
There are. There are several studies that look at education levels, and consistently in the South, education levels have been much higher. And again, I think empowerment comes from higher education and a higher ability to earn for the family, which gives a woman some decision-making power.
Here's a listener who writes, I'm an Indian male who migrated to the United States in 1999 at age 22. I've been routinely visiting India and have a majority of my friends and family back in India. It's a sad evolution in a country where there are so many women deities that women are treated as second-class citizens, irrespective of income, education, etc. Not to blame the victim, but women themselves have been brainwashed into coveting a male child and doting over their sons and treating their daughters as inferior. There are exceptions, of course, but unfortunately, in my experience, it is pervasive across a broad section of Indian society. Amana?
Well, I think what's important to understand is that you know, mothers are most of the time living with their extended family. They're living with their in-laws. And so, you know, they're subjected to all sorts of pressures, especially if those in-laws, you know, want to have a son. You know, they'll pressure her, they'll taunt her and humiliate her if she does bear a girl child. And so, you know, I think it's difficult to blame women in those situations for wanting, you know, to have a boy, just because if they don't, they often will kind of face torture and beating.
Bring another caller on. Tanya, that's you. Welcome. You're on Forum.
Yes, Michael. Great topic, and everybody's doing a wonderful job in bringing up great points. What I wanted to say is, I'll be short and say, raise better boys to be better men, raise better girls to be better women. So we need to women, as a woman, we need to support other women. And I, being a single parent, being an Indian descent, I've been here 30 years in the Bay Area, my son would not do any of these things, because my father empowered all four girls. We have no brothers. And that's how I empowered my daughter. She would not fall for a boy who would mistreat her. So I think Bollywood does play a role. We could educate people through Bollywood movies. I think that's the best way to do it. And in India, we suppress sex. If you could educate men and women, what is their feelings are, what they're suppressing this, and then one way they're worshiping as a goddess, female, then they go and see her as a sex object on the street and how it's been mistreated. It's really sad.
Tanya, we got seconds left. What would you what do you think mothers should tell their sons?
They're suppressing their feelings. They need to treat a woman as they are somebody's daughter. They're somebody's, you know. So do you think they will be treated, their daughters will be treated like that? No.
RESPECT, as the great Aretha Franklin said. I think that is the key, and I think you've said it well, and our guests have as well, and I thank all of you for being with us here on Forum. We spoke earlier with Julia McCarthy, correspondent based in New Delhi for NPR. Amana Fontanella Khan will be speaking at City Lights Bookstore tonight at 7. Her book, again, is The Pink Sari Revolution, A Tale of Women in Power in India. We thank Sunita Sarabji, who is a staff reporter for India West, and Sonia Falero, who's the author of Beautiful Thing, Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bars. And thank you, our listeners, because we wouldn't be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for listening. Thank you for being with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.